you can grab some seats and we can shut the door. I'm afraid we will be using the microphone and you have to kind of speak near to it. And
then no, you can hear me, can't you hear the voice?
You can hear Superman, Stan.
Hello.
Okay, well, this is going to be a really good session. I'm really looking forward to it, especially, as I say, having four fantastic speakers. So everybody knows Stan. He's just disappeared for a moment. Who is a real expert by experience and now getting a bit of a national reputation for all his work for the homeless. And Helen Davis, who is a consultant in health and wellbeing, which sounds wonderful, and I think she will make us feel good. But she and Stan have done some research together, and I think we'll probably be hearing more about that now. So I'll hand over to Helen.
Okay, thanks, Pippa. Thanks everyone for joining us. What we're going to try to do is Stan and I give you an idea, way we can't hear, of how Pathways approaching the whole range of activities of hearing from, listening to, and being influenced by the lived experience of people with homelessness. It's a work in progress, and we're delighted to have 16 people in our team this year, more than ever, and more visible, vocal, and influential across the conference than ever. So thanks to all of them, and they're helping us refine our own approach and pathway. So just to start, and then Stan's going to tell you the kind of journey that we're on, the story so far, and then I, being a bureaucrat, will tell you a bit about the procedural stuff that we're doing to try and nail it down and make it sustainable. But Stan and I thrashed this out. We had a long conversation about what do we actually mean when we're talking about an expert by experience in pathway. So we think it's someone who's able to bring the lessons and experience from their own lived experience, their own life experience. And we don't expect people to be experts in everything. None of us is an expert in everything. And we've had comments from previous members of the experts team about, well, I don't know about hospitals, or I don't know about mental health services. That's fine. People are bringing their own expertise, and it's hugely significant. They're in a unique position to connect to others as peer supporters, advocates, just making people, bringing other people in. And the individual and collective voices of those experts really add weight and value to what Pathway and the faculty does. When we're talking to NHS colleagues, local government, national government, those voices, either the individual stories from, or the collective themes from those, is helping us achieve what we want as Pathway and the faculty. So Stan will tell you a bit about the story, and then I'll tell you a bit about the bureaucracy, but it's not that bad.
The story began for my involvement with Pathways about 4 years, or getting on very close to 4 years. It was still going through lots of process, lots of changes. That had been running since it started up in 2009. It really kind of started to take off in 2012, back in 2011, when Josie became the first person with experience to work for the organisation in the form of a care navigator trainee, and going on to be a senior care navigator this day. The bit that I got involved with initially was capturing a voice. I got given the commission by public health to just find some basic information. So capturing the voices of people with the experience and with knowledge of homelessness, what was their opinion on, it was actually on whether they'd engage with an online system. And the idea, the thinking came from that, well actually, it's great to get people's voices involved and get them to hear what people have to say and then to be able to act on that. So three or four pieces down the line, we started to introduce those people into Pathway themselves. So it wasn't a case of getting their voices and bringing their opinions on pieces of paper. It was bringing them to Pathway to be able to talk about those things themselves, to deliver their own voices to the professionals, the people who work in healthcare. We did our first conference. This is conference number 4, for those who've not been to and have missed out on the great ones before. And we started with a very small team, I think, 5 people, around about that figure, of people with lived experience. And they worked with me, and they came to that conference, and it has slowly built up. We had 16 people up to the first day of conference. Unfortunately, 2 of those dropped off, but that's what happens if you have a go to a conference everywhere. Not every delegate who's registered will turn up. What that means for us, and for me as leading that up, it's important for me, because the people that I enjoy working with, the people that bring so much colour to what the work we do, are the people that sit in here, the pockets of groups there and at the back, they're fantastic, they're brilliant. They bring so much, it's fun, it's great, but so much insight and knowledge into this to help people to understand actually what it's like being homeless, what it's like trying to access healthcare, what it's like trying to go through a dentistry programme, and I did some work on that. What the transitions are like from adult, from child mental health services to adult mental health services. Things that we don't have a clue, I certainly don't have, and nobody's expected to have all that knowledge. One professional is expected to know everything about everything. However, what you have with a core group of people with youth experience is the ability to be able to capture that knowledge and to learn from them. What we've done, and we've been really fortunate in the people that have chosen to give their time to us and to come and work with us, is what we've done is we've created a platform with them where people don't just listen to what is being said, they actually hear what is being said. And one of the best stories that came out about the power of the voices of the people with lived experience actually come from an organisation called Bevan Health, Bradford, who went away after, I think, either the first or the second conference, after hearing stuff that was going on, being delivered by international speakers about street medicine. They thought about it, they'd been involved in the whole process, and engaged with the people with lived experience, and then went off, got a van and started doing it. Just done it. That was it. The whole thing kind of comes together. It's brilliant working with them. There's ups and downs. The slates and ladders, this thing here, is kind of, it's symbolic. One thing that you should notice about this, and it's the same wherever you go, they're all the same. The layout may be different. There is never, ever going to be a slate that takes you back to the start. So if you start engaging with people with lived experience in your projects, in your work, and bringing them on, you're never, ever going to not have made progress. The minute you start, you've made progress. And you can't undo the progress because there's no way of getting back there. But in the same breath, there's no fast track. It is a process. There's lots of ups and downs, lots of fun. If I can tell you that the way we kind of do it is slightly different in the fact that we put in place, and we're fortunate enough to be held tight, but also given some free rein by our directors, that we don't spend money at £5 on a sandwich. We'll spend £5 going out for something to eat. So we'll go and eat as a group. It becomes an opportunity to bond with those people and make them feel as if they are part of that team, which they are, a massive part of what we do. Every report that Pathway delivers now has involvement in the voice of people with lived experience in it. And it's an example I'd like to think that everybody will follow, because we can all sit and write something based on our own opinion. But is it ours, or is it everybody's? Is it going to make a difference? So working with Helen, and this is the bit where it kind of, for me, it becomes more difficult now, because I've got to work with Helen to become more professional. So anyone knows of where Helen can go and work now, it's really good I'll give her the opportunity to leave. But she's great. No, we've got to do it and make it more structured. It's worked by being so flexible, and we need to work out how to make it structured but still retain that sort of fluid approach. Because I mentioned at the beginning, two people haven't come, we've gone through the whole processes of the support mechanism and training and stuff that we put in place, but they haven't got to this point. So we need to be fluid, and we need to understand actually people we're working with, they do change, they do move on, they move around, their lives go up and down, and that's fair. And I think there's an acceptance that happens. But all I would say, if you haven't taken up the challenge of involving people within your service, people with lived experience do it. It's such a blast, I promise you. And we'll help, you know. And if you get Stephanie, she'll tell you how to keep me on the chair, because she does a really good job. She's one of the few people who can. So she's going to do the rest of the professional bit. I'm going to sit and work.
No, we're both professionals. Just to say that one of the things we've tried to do is to look at what's good practice out there. And like Stan says, we want to capture, keep that fluidity and the authenticity of what we're hearing and the challenge. It's brilliant being challenged by people who say, oh, that's rubbish, and that is really good. And people who are committed to also telling us what might make it better. I think that's great, not just being told where it's going wrong, but what would help. So we looked at this. Some of you came to a presentation yesterday. This, I'll just flag this up. NSUN is the National Survivor User Network led by people living with mental illness. And the 4PI involvement standard is something that they develop with partners with DH funding. And it's a really good, simple framework for how you approach the whole task. And these questions, I think, are great trigger questions in any organization, large or small, thinking about the principles. How do we want to treat each other and be treated? The purpose, why are we involving people? Or as people with lived experience, why are we becoming involved? And I think this is really important because it reminds us that at every step of the process, there has to be a purpose to the involvement of both the organisation and the individual. We've both got to get something meaningful and valued out of it. Who is going to be involved? Have we got the right people? Have we got the right diversity representing the people that we're seeking to support? How and what difference will it make? So there's loads of online resources from these guys, and we'll upload the 4PI report on the conference site to help you. But we had a bit of a think of this, about this early on in our process, and we are trying to capture what we're doing and what we're aiming for. And just a reminder that for all of us in the faculty, this is part of the faculty's ambition, very much led by Aidan and the values that he brought to it about putting the patient back at the heart of healthcare. So we're very much aiming to live out that ambition for the faculty. So within the pathway, I'm sorry this is too scrunched up, it's my rushing to do this in the break, but you'll see this online. We've just tried to identify for ourselves what are the core principles. And also I think it's important, because often you've got someone championing involvement. What when they move on? I'm not saying stand where I plan it to go anywhere, but you know, stuff happens. We want to really embed it and nail it down within all our organisations, I think. Just a couple of things to flag up here. We recognise, the second point, we recognise that both staff and experts by experience need training and support to get this right. I think it's not just training up people with lived experience, but that has been absolutely crucial. This year we've had three conference days with support from a guy called Paul Waters to really help people think about how they get their points across, how they listen, how they co-facilitate, etc. So we invest quite heavily in helping experts get it right and be confident, but we also need to invest in helping staff get it right. It's not the easiest thing to do, and across the faculty we're going to be trying to pull together practical resources from services, both within the faculty and elsewhere, that help make it easier to get involvement right. So we've just got some principles underlying it, and you know, also based on a working assumption that staff out there in services don't go into healthcare to get it wrong and treat people disrespectfully, but sometimes don't know how to get it right. So it's that kind of sense of we're going to try and improve it together. I presume I need to shut up and hurry up.
No, you've got to.
Okay. So we've developed a sort of in-house policy to nail some of it down that's based on some of these whole process things about incentives. Like Stan said, it's not, I think, incentivizing involvement, whether through access to a valuable conference that a lot of delegates, a lot of our colleagues can't afford to come to, or thank you incentives or meals out, a whole range of things.
I think also something really simple that after the training had taken place on our final day, at the end of the final day of that, our new chair and the chief exec came in and just sat and had a conversation with the group, with the entire group. And that, coming from the top, if you've got an organisation that shows support for that happening, and it's from the very top of the organisation, it automatically gives it a worth, gives it a value. And that just, it's very simple things that make it work, that make it happen. I think that it's. I've been around for long enough to know that unwittingly there are lots of organisations who pay lip service to the whole concept of involving people with experience. And I'm not naive enough to believe that that's completely gone. But I'm not harsh enough to believe that it's deliberate. I think that there is a naivety to it. There's a fear of engaging people who are quite chaotic very often. However, solutions around chaos are they have far more impact than solutions around stability. So solutions around stability will not hit the targets that you want to hit. you won't be able to get them. So it's great to work with people who are very near to that point, because the rawness of it, it demonstrates that you're not prepared to bleach anything out, because we don't want to do that, and it doesn't make much sense doing that. But I think there's lots of pointers that we can sort of say. But I think we've got some airspace during the Q&A, we've got a pocket time in the Q&A. Actually, if any of the EPEs that have come for Pathway today, if they're prepared to answer questions for you, that actually, for me, might be a better way of you finding out, because I can sell you double glazing, but these are the people that are going to go through the process or have been, and they're going to give you much more what's working for them. And actually, if it comes up with what's not working, we can change it, and we're happy to do that. So, yeah, I would pull on my sword, I'm happy to do that. So if they're happy to do that during the Q&A, perhaps they'll identify themselves and you can ask them the questions and get them involved and listen to what they have to say.
Two things, I promise, that's all. One of the practical things, so we've got our internal policy stands developed, brilliant handbook that captures some of our practical experience of how to make these things real, which we're working to refine with people who've been involved with us. And we're happy to share all this when we've kind of got them to a point we're happy. And then we've got a kind of charter that we're developing, which is one page, and I've been reliably told by the experts it's way too wordy and I need to strip a whole lot out, so that's my next job. But just really stating, because I don't think you can state often enough the core principles about, and it's what this is it's what we as Pathway commit to doing in supporting experts' involvement and what experts commit to doing in being involved and being part of a team, because you bring people with very different needs and perspectives together, it doesn't always run smoothly. So they're just about valuing each person's contributions, taking care with confidential information. You know, people share a lot of stuff with us. We've done quite a lot of work thinking about disclosure, how much you share of your own story, what happens with that once you've shared it, it's no longer yours in a way. So thinking about that sort of thing, respecting each other and valuing the differences that people bring. Make it easy to participate, just the practicalities around the meeting and stuff, but also looking after our health and well-being, because people all come with needs. Very much saying to people, we want you to stay well through this process. If you have particular needs, tell us. It might be something like not being able to travel in the rush hour because of anxiety, or being in recovery and not wanting to be around other people who are drinking. So all of our shared meals are drink-free. You came up with some of the experts, the idea of an abstinence buddy if we go to the pub and that kind of thing. So very practical ways worked out with our team to try and make it real, but it is a journey. This is the cycle of learning from NSUN, and I like it because it's got make things happen in the middle, but it also assumes that we'll keep going, you know, we won't crack it. So a bit like the snakes and ladders, we will have to keep going around that loop to get it better and better. That's where we're at. Happy to hand over to the chair.
Fantastic. Anybody else work with experts by experience? Apart from Pathway, yes. Where are you?
So my name is Shamik and I work at Freedom from Torture.
Where?
Freedom from Torture.
Freedom from Torture.
Yeah. So we're a charity providing clinical care to survivors of torture. And
so we'll hear more about that in the questions. And where do you work with experts? Yes.
Sorry.
I mean, I think you felt move on to the... Would it be better to have questions on your talk? Because the two talks are actually quite different. Or would you rather...
I'm just worried about timing.
We'll come back to YouTube after we've heard from Caroline and Bryony. Is that all right if we just do the passive care?
Because that's part of yours as well.
Caroline, you'll all know from Pathway Work, well, King's. But I actually read she started life as a senior lecturer in malaria and maternal problems in Africa, went from there to Hackney and now to King's and saving the homeless. And Bryony, I'm afraid you'll have to tell us more about yourself in a minute. So I'll hand over to you two.
Thank you. So, yeah, so that's me. I'm working at Pathway, King's Health Partners, and at UCL. And Bryony?
I'm from UCL.
So what we're going to be talking about is a project that this is just really interim findings. We have really started this project a few months ago. We've got quite a long way to go, but we have got some really exciting findings that we'd like to share. And it follows on so beautifully after that amazing presentation by Marg and Wendy. So it really just shows that what a need we have for this kind of qualitative piece of work that we're doing. It's not just us, it's a whole collaborative study funded by the Oak Foundation, and it's a collaboration with Mungo's Pathway, CMC from the Royal Marsden, and the Marie Curie Palliative Care Plant at UCL. And I have to mention just Julian Daly, who's over there, who is a care navigator now, was an expert by experience, so he's an expert by experience and a care navigator. And he's been very much involved with the development of this study. He's on our steering group, and he's going to be really coming to his own in later parts of the study. So why are we doing this? I mean, I think everyone was at the morning talk, and it's really clear why we need to do this. And what we're doing is it's very much a qualitative study. We are out there speaking, and Brian's going to tell you a little bit more about who we're speaking to, but basically getting views from everybody who works with homeless people, working in different areas of so there's healthcare providers, hostel staff, outreach staff, and homeless people themselves and experts by experience, to look at what are the issues relating to the challenges for end of life care and what needs to be in place. How can we help support homeless people to live and die well? As we all know, there are high numbers of young deaths amongst homeless people. These deaths are often really not good deaths. There's very limited advanced care planning. And there's many reasons for this. There's a huge avoidance of the subject of death. There's also a huge amount of uncertainty about when people are going to die. So you're dealing a lot with people with advanced liver disease, where the trajectories are very uncertain. People have a number of episodes where you think, you know, they're extremely sick and they bounce back, and with changes in lifestyle, things can be very different. So we're dealing with a huge amount of uncertainty. And deaths are often sort of sudden, but not unexpected. And in the UK, there's been actually quite a limited amount of work in this area. There's been some fantastic work done by Peter Kennedy at the Mungo's, along with the Marie Curie team at UCL. And we are building on that. We're working with them to build further on that. And they've got a fantastic resource pack for hostel staff. So I'll hand over to Brian.
So Caroline's outlined some of the reasons that we're doing this research. What I'd like to do now is just tell you precisely what it is we're trying to do and outline some of our research aims. So as we've read on the screen, we're looking to develop a richer understanding of the complexities and needs of end-of-life care for homeless people from all perspectives. Through this research, we're aiming to provide a platform for the voices of homeless people and those working with them around the areas of end of life care and the challenges that involves. We're also looking to extend the training that's been developed, that Caroline just mentioned, on end of life issues for additional professional groups, and to make recommendations for policy and practice and service provision moving forward. So how are we doing this? We've been working since we began data collection, I guess, around October, and we've been conducting group discussions with a range of different experts in the field of homelessness. We started off with experts by experience, and just heard some really, really useful insights into the challenges faced and how we can move the research forward, particularly thinking about how we're going to work with homeless people as the research continues. We've also spoken with a lot of hostel and outreach staff, with hostel managers, and with healthcare professionals. So a range really, we've spoken to GPs, nurses, and we've been speaking to drug and alcohol specialists. And the final group that we'll be speaking to are homeless people themselves. And we wanted to leave this group until the end to make sure that we had all of the knowledge that we need and all of the supports in place to support homeless people talking about this very difficult subject. We've been recruiting people across three boroughs, from Lambeth, Westminster and Hackney. And we've been asking them to tell us a little about their experiences in end-of-life care and what they see as some of the challenges and potential opportunities for improving this.
So our initial findings are that there are massive gaps in the options available to homeless people with advanced illness and those supporting them. And I'm going to sort of, first of all, just give a few flavours of examples of what has come up with hostel staff in some of our focus groups. outlining some of the real challenges that people are working with. So first of all, this is, again, speaking to a hostel worker, a key worker within a hostel, and she was talking about somebody who was very sick. As much as we wanted to try and stretch our shifts in order to accommodate her and try to make her room not be covered in urine and faeces, we also had up to 30 other residents in the hostel as well. It was really hard to get social services support. It was really, 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 really hard to get that. And to begin with, I think they only wanted to give us 2 hours a week. And another example here. In the past, we've tried to put people into hospice. One person we did get in there, and he was asked to leave because of his behaviour when drunk. And in the end, he died in the hostel. He had cancer. And then another area which I know so many people have raised, there is a massive, massive gap, and that's people who are young with dementia. We fought and fought with the social work team and threatened to go to the papers, and we got him into a nursing home. A year later, he comes up for review, has no one advocating for him, and they evict him for not meeting the criteria. A year ago, he had Korsakoff's, and you're not getting better from that. He couldn't remember his own age or anything. He went missing, and I found him in a morgue a few months later. That's how our clients are treated calmly. So what we've heard actually a lot over the last 2 days is that we are trying to work with putting a square peg in a round hole. There's huge lack of adequate, flexible services for people whose health is deteriorating. Hostels are doing an incredible job in trying to deal with people with increasing complexity with limited resources. And what really has struck us is that they're saying that the complexity, the high support need hostels, the complexity is increasing and increasing. And they're actually taking people who are younger and younger into these high support need hostels. There's massive challenges that they have in supporting adequate, in providing adequate support for people. There's low staff-client ratios and often very, very little night cover. So even when they have got somebody who's very sick, who they've agreed and they're trying to care for, there may only be one or two people working at night. And they have recurrently had difficulty in accessing social services. This does seem to be different in different boroughs, but you know, out of our three boroughs, two have had the most incredible difficulty in getting social services to do any assessments of people within the hostel. So they can't get packages of care, which means that hostel staff end up having to provide personal care, which is obviously not what they're there for, and they may refuse, and hostel managers obviously can't force anyone to do that. Now, there are very mixed views from hostel managers, because I must apologise that most of our work so far has been with hostel staff. The healthcare provider work we're just starting, so incorporated into this is mainly our work from speaking to hospital and outreach staff. Very mixed views as to whether a hostel could or should be developed to become a place of care and death as people's health deteriorates. At the moment, there is actually very little choice. At the moment, there are very few places where people with increasing support needs can go. And so hostels are often being in a position where they end up having to look after somebody who they haven't got the facilities to look after. Or they end up sending them to hospital and then sometimes refusing to have them back because their support needs are too great. We even heard of somebody who was discharged actually to the street because the hostel couldn't take them back. And they ended up having to try really hard to advocate for them to get into somewhere else. On the other hand, people are saying, but, you know, and this will become much more apparent when we get onto our next phase, that the hostel is their home and we need to work at enabling people to die in their home. But again, we've still got the main part of this study to come, which is our work and speaking with homeless people. The other problem is there's an ethos difference. Hostels are basically see themselves as having a recovery model, not a palliative model. And there's a feeling that hostel environment is too chaotic, and there are also major safeguarding concerns when you have somebody who's very sick. and vulnerable within that chaotic environment. And obviously there's a massive impact on staff and residents, though some of the hostels had worked out amazing ways of working with bereavement with staff and with the other residents. So again, we've got so much to share, but obviously we can't do it all today. One of the really burning issues, though, was, you know, we need to be doing stuff earlier on. We shouldn't be doing so much that is around end of life when actually there is a lot that we can be doing to prevent the deterioration that is actually currently happening. So again, our whole groups were around talking about people with deteriorating health, not just in the last few weeks or few months of life. And it was felt a lot that there's a huge lack of services and choices out there. That at the moment, there's certainly in the boroughs we looked at, most of the hostels are wet hostels. So if somebody's been detoxed in hospital, they end up having nowhere to go except back into a wet hostel. And often, even if they go into rehab, after rehab, they may end up back in a place that they've been before, which was a wet hostel, which seems extraordinary. And there's very little relapse support out there as well. People felt that if somebody has been through rehab and has stopped drinking, then they have what they call a lapse, they may end up straight back at the beginning in a wet hostel because that's the only place that will take them. There's also this constantly raised, this kind of missed window of opportunity. And I'll just finish off the results really talking about one case of a 42-year-old man with advanced liver disease. He had a hospital admission. He was very, very sick with encephalopathy and sepsis. And he was dry in hospital for 4 weeks and wasn't trying to get out of hospital to get a drink. He was very sick, so that's why he was in for quite a long time. And he said he wanted to remain abstinent. Anyway, he was assessed by alcohol teams while he was in hospital and deemed not appropriate for rehab because in the past, in the community, he had shown a lack of engagement with any sort of alcohol services in the community, and he also had some cognitive impairment, so it was felt that he wouldn't be able to engage with the rehab process. So he was discharged to the only place available, which was a wet hostel. Inevitably, he returned to drinking, had multiple readmissions, and died suddenly and supposedly unexpectedly in the hostel. I'm now going to hand over back to Brian.
So the previous example, highlighted some of the challenges in advanced care planning for homeless people. We've seen that planning in advanced care planning is often currently lacking, and this is due to a number of reasons. There's a whole range of complexities and uncertainties in caring for homeless people with advanced illness, as we've heard in this presentation and in others. And this might explain some of the reasons why the advanced care planning conversations are currently being held as a rule. There's complexity around who should start conversations. Should it be hospital staff? Should it be medical staff? Should be a specialist palliative care person, and when these conversations should begin. And how do you begin these conversations when somebody is very vulnerable and very fragile? And there's been a discussion about the recognition of the importance of having these conversations, but at the moment they seem to be more like a warning than a discussion. So conversations are often, if you don't stop drinking, you'll be dead in 6 months. This is rarely followed up with advice about how the quality of these 6 months can be improved. Choice over the last couple of months of their life. Another important thing that came up from advanced care planning is what to do with this information once it's gathered. Who should this information be shared with and how should it be shared? And this is something that we're going to need to explore a lot further in our research with homeless people in the future. So far, we've talked a bit about some of the challenges of palliative care and advanced care planning for homeless people. And what I'd like to do now is just to summarise some of the recommendations. Just to highlight, these are preliminary, we haven't finished the research, so it's quite early days to be doing this. So uncertainty seems to be quite a key theme that comes up again and again around lots of different aspects of palliative care. And it seems that we can learn to incorporate this uncertainty into our care and advanced care planning for homeless people. One of the ways of doing this was increasing the amount of parallel planning that's done. So keeping hope there, keeping options open, but at the same time making plans for what should happen deteriorate, so people have control over the care they receive at the end of their life. the residents can expect as health deteriorates. We've seen some really great examples of support being in hospitals when a resident dies and how the staff support each other and other homeless people. And the palliative care coordinator model has been seen to be extremely important, but that's a model that really could be extended. So hospitals also need more support in terms of personal care for residents and greater integration between health and social care to relieve some of the burden that's currently on hospital staff. And early and sustained input from palliative care specialists is going to really help. And for all of this to happen, we need greater communication between and relationships between hospitals, hospitals and hospices. So those are some of the recommendations that we've made so far from our discussion with experts. But in order for these to be implemented, there needs to be real change in the services that are available. We need more options for homeless people at the end of their lives. Whether this is a wet facility or a dry facility, there needs to be a choice there for either. And all of the support services need to be very specialised, particularly as needs increase. And really it all points to more integration of health and social care to give more person-centred holistic care at the end of life. And the research that we've done has been conducted in three boroughs in Lambeth, Westminster and Hackney. And just across those boroughs we've seen really large variation in the services that are available. And given that the services that we need are so specialised, it really would make sense for a more pan-Lambeth approach to be taken.
So this is the last slide, I promise. So what's next for this research, really? So obviously we've got further interviews with specialist healthcare professionals and with homeless people. And we are going to be using this information to extend and further develop training for professional groups, so working on the work that's already been done by St Mungo's and Marie Curie. And we hope that we can influence commissioners and have an impact on what is available. Obviously, there would be no point in doing this work if we thought we couldn't make a change. And it's absolutely vital that a change is made and the whole service and systems are looked at so that we can improve the lives of incredibly vulnerable people who really do deserve better than they're getting at the moment. So thank you very much for listening, and we'd love to hear more about your experiences, concerns, comments about these issues.
Helen Stamp, do you want to come and join Brian and Caroline? I mean, marvellous talks. And one theme, of course, that came out was listen to the homeless. They're the ones who can advise better than anyone. What's the problem? What's needed? What can we do? And I can see some experts in the room. Thank you so much. And do say, if there's anything you want to say, do speak up. Just before you address your questions, would you mind if we have 1 minute about the victims of torture and Lincoln, about how you've used your experts? Just a very quick couple of minutes.
Do you mind standing up and introducing yourself?
So I'm sorry, actually. My name is Shmeen. I work for an organisation called Freedom from Torture, and I manage survivor activism there. And one of the groups that we work with there is a group called Survivor Speak Out. I have to say, we've got three members of the group here today. Funny enough, they're not in this session. So I'm sorry, usually they need to explain themselves. But basically, Survivor Speak Out is a group of survivors of torture who have come together to speak out against torture. And we go and we meet with decision makers, and we run capacity building workshops at the Home Office. We reach out to decision makers and try to create a bit of change and really just put forward recommendations for change so that they're actually ensuring that decisions are formed by those with disabilities. It's a really, really valuable piece of work, and I have lots of questions for these guys in the room actually, because I think there's lots of learning.
Yeah, I wonder if we should have more on torture included in some of our workshops.
I should say there's a workshop being run by the Society of Catholic.
Brilliant. And just 1 minute, you're using experts, did you say, in Lincoln?
No, in Northeast Lincolnshire. Anything that we commission in this
One, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, lovely.
Is that because of the fact that they're in a hostel and they're like in the stable, or because of the complexities and dealing with the addicts and problematic users?
Sorry, the question was to you.
Thanks, that's a brilliant question. I think it's because they're in a hostel, and I think it's because of the complexity of their problems. What is interesting is where people did get hostels, did get social services to come in and do packages of care, it wasn't very successful either, because there was a different carer every day, they were in a rush, and that really didn't go down very well with the resident who needed the support quite clearly. And also they're very inflexible with the timing. So I think it's a double problem. But the problem at the moment is hostels are finding it virtually impossible in some areas to get any assessment done in a hostel. So shocking situation.
Most importantly, we go through a whole process of actually talking to them and explaining that you only say as much or as little as you feel comfortable. Can anyone hear me? Is that all right?
It's being recorded.
Oh, sorry. So we talk to them about how much or how little they wish to divulge about themselves and their life history. And for them to realise that it's there, they own it, and they can say as much as they want. We have been a little bit naive in relation to that, so what we've begun doing, and it's a relatively new process, is also talking to them about what happens once they've spoken about themselves and they've released the information about themselves, what happens to it. We're grateful for Paul's at the back of the room, we're grateful for him to come in on this occasion and talk about what happens to that voice if it's released into a media organisation, and the fact that it's gone, they can't claim that back, although it's their story. Kind of got theirs anymore, they don't own it. But we were naive, and you know, the whole thing about being fluid is it gives us the scope to be able to learn as well. So I think that's what we've done. But so we've got some here, so maybe they might want to pick up on that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Donald, isn't it? Yes. Yeah. Did you want to add anything about that?
Yeah,
being vulnerable, exploited?
Being vulnerable, exploited, get involved with pathways. Working with our structure, we were able to meet people with similar problems and views, and being from the non-medical side, we didn't have any constraints to conversations we could have amongst ourselves, and that gave us the confidence that we were amongst other people who were in similar circumstances, and we could let go as much as we felt comfortable letting go. And it's a great experience to be able to speak to each other openly about things that you just normally bury and don't talk to anyone about.
Thank you so much.
Much.
Have you all seen the films made by the experts about their life stories? Or what's it called?
We did a piece of work with Fonterra called Stories of Rebirth.
Stories of Rebirth, amazing. Watch them. Learn, listen, use them in your teaching, whenever, it's just unbelievable, so moving. And I think you've won 8, 9...
The organisation did, we work with them, and they won 8 industry awards on the back of that.
8 industry awards.
The powerful way they did. It is testimony that the people that come and work with us trust us. And that's it, as we've built up that trust. Is Ian in the room? Is he somewhere? because Ian was supposed to co-chair everything.
I forgot.
No.
Can I just say on the flip side of that as well? I think it is also about us being assertive, being having conversations with policymakers about what we are offering. We're not offering up people's stories on the plate. It's negotiated. What we've done, I mean, we did some really good work, I think, in CQC, building on from the previous conference where we got a group of people together to share in a way that Don's just very nicely described, the safe space, to share their experience with primary care. We collated and anonymized it and shared with CQC. So there were people who were willing and able to share their personal story, others who we were encouraging to say, you don't have to describe your story, to share the lessons that arose from it. And I think that's advice that came to us from mental health. So I could use a net movement that your story is your own, the lessons from it instead of the impact. But I think we as services and sort of mediators sometimes have to be quite certain with the people that we're offering to bring involvement to about what we will and won't offer once we agree with our own rules.
Excuse me, how do you get access to this point?
I'll get a link. I'll post a link up I have a link posted on our website. But it's also on Fonterra London if you look for stories of rebirth. Fonterra, as in front of Era.
They're only a few minutes long and just learning and teaching. So,
right, I know you're desperate, but hang on, where's number 3, 4, 5, and 6? I'll just do number 3. Who's 4? 4, who's 5, 6, 7?
Hi there, I'm Phil, MPB team. It's not a question, it's just more a comment. I live in a hospital and I witness what these people have researched. I see wheelchair users having to shuffle downstairs because the lift is broken. Now, I live in a hospital with chaotic drug users. I'm lucky enough to have got sober in there, but I am at risk still of relapse. If being living there a year, I've still got no joy in moving out there. So, yeah, it's just good to see that the research is doing it. It is true, just to let everybody know it is hard out there.
Hey, you are an amazing man. Well done. Come on, you're so strong. Oh, fantastic.
Four. Again, a comment, really. I worked in a hospital for a number of years, and I also manage an outreach service, and I've had experienced quite a lot of people dying, either suddenly and unexpectedly, or because they've been chronically ill and had to deal with arranging funerals and everything. And I remember when I first went to the hostel, my director asked questions about why I was crying and because it was seen as unprofessional. And I certainly never got any support from anybody to deal with all these deaths. And I think that's one of the reasons why I don't do face-to-face work anymore, because I just got burnt out with it. So I think what is really important and what I see is that one is to allow people that are working with people that are homeless and vulnerable, that they are allowed to care about them and form relationships and be upset when they die, and that there is adequate support within the system for them to do that. And I think whether it comes to people commissioning services to make sure that's in the spec, you know, that that is actually considered within the service spec, that there is some kind of bereavement support for people, because whether we like it or not, we're dealing with a client group. Oh, you're right. Thank you so much for that.
I'm
sorry. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Ian Harrison. I'm homelessness in Liverpool. It's just an observation, really. From a hostel point of view, as a GP practice as well, we try to work towards gold standards, preferred places of care. One of the issues that we've come across is pain control, and obviously the reluctance of the hostel staff to issue controlled drugs. It's major for us at the moment, and I think two really bad experiences have rolled out, which made other hostels very reluctant to do that. And the other observation as well is with these patients as well is the fact that you put very sick people in the most non-professional 24-hour care. So it's an observation, these medication and putting without the nursing sort of 24-hour care. It needs to be looked at as well.
Yeah.
Did you want to come back?
Yeah, I might, if I could, come back on both of those. No, thank you. I think those are two, they're absolutely we're really finding this. I mean, there are different ways that hostels are working in terms of supporting staff, and it's something that actually, again, we obviously haven't presented everything. We've spent quite a lot of time finding out what supports people do have, and we have had some people, shocking stories where there hasn't been support, and others where there has been very good support. So hopefully lessons again will be learned about what support people have found effective as well. But absolutely. And again, regarding pain relief, that's come up really with our more recent groups, which actually are post-dated when we prepared this, which were again with the healthcare, the nurse practitioners who found this. It's a major, major problem, is hostel staff being happy to have controlled drugs within them. And I think they got by with some fentanyl patches were accepted at one point. But again, it's we're expecting hostel staff to do work that really in any other area they wouldn't be doing. It's really very astounding.
And just I'm not highly collecting from knowledge that duty chairs that visit. My question was back about the exploitation of patients, because I had that experience on several occasions inviting patients to a group of commissioners, to a group of professionals who are incredibly interested in looking at their stories, but then ask questions which are completely inappropriate or really hurtful to those patients. I was just wondering how you help patients, you've done this from knowledge of that, you know, how do you provide any training or any support, how to protect patients to be actually injured in those sessions by professionals?
I think what we do try to do, as I said earlier on, we try to talk to people about the information that they're happy to release. And certainly we would, if there was, say for instance, a meeting on abuse or sexual abuse or violent abuse, and one of the people we were working with had experienced that but wasn't happy about talking about that within an open forum, it isn't something that we were supportively going to do. They would not be taken to that, either supported or said, you know, do you want to get involved in this? So we try to give people options. We can't account for everybody, you know, so there's a lot of naivety out there, and it's just misplaced. I don't believe it's to be malicious in any way. I think that what we try to do, what we're constantly trying to do, is to help people to grow their own confidence. Because being confident, you're able to say, I'm not happy with that. If somebody asks me a question I wasn't happy with, I'd say, no one will answer that. I paid a politician. So we try to install that thinking process with our experts. So we've got some of the others, and we've got actually, it would be good to bring one of the others at the back there, who are kind of relatively new, because they would perhaps explain how that process works for them, those conversations take place. Do you want to do that? Yeah.
And the whole thing coming through here is this total lack of respect, which is something as a hospital doctor I try to teach, that it's a lack of respect to patients, it's a lack of a need, a lack of understanding, a sort of feeling you can ask them anything, it's bad. So hello, you're Terry.
I'll answer it. When I first started working with Pathways, did tell us from the offset that we can do what we want to do with respect as far as our own personal experience. You know, we didn't have to tell anybody anything about us. We didn't want them to know what this was. So we were very professional about it, very helpful, very supportive. So we'll leave it there.
Thank you, Terry. Did you want to say anything, Helen, or should we go on?
That's fine.
Okay. I think you were next. Thank you. You've come all the way from Canada.
So I wanted to say, first of all, I love the EBE thing. I'm going to take that back to Canada. But I wonder, we also have people with lived experience who are working for us. And in Canada, they're called peers. So we have peer workers. And when we were doing a pilot for a new version of peer working that we were doing, one of the things that emerged from our pure purgatory. And pure purgatory is where you get enough inside the door that you have a say in how things are operated, and maybe you get a stipend for your time and you get meals or transportation, but you don't ever actually get a real job. And so you're kind of part of the team, you're not really part of the team, and the reason you're not really part of the team is because you don't have that real job. And there's lots of debate going on about what's the part that you get to do as citizens, and as citizens who want to have a say in the services that you use, which is your right, and what and at what point does that change, where you should be somebody who's compensated for the expertise that you bring in a meaningful way. And I wonder whether that's a conversation that happens here, and if it is, what the conversation sounds like.
I think we can lead by example. We've got a very small team based at UCH, and in the team that we have within the hospital setting, there are now four people with lived experience who've come through a training process, and they're now care navigators. I am a former service user, expert by experience. I'm employed to lead projects involving other people. We're constantly on the lookout for organisations to begin to not just embrace the token gesture of listening, but actually take them on board. Some of the EBs that we've got with us now, one's just about to start with St Mungo's, another one is about to go and work with an organisation in Norwich, and we're constantly trying to demonstrate that it isn't something which should be just sat around on the outside, thanks very much, pat on the head, off you go. It actually gives value to an organisation, and you know, we've got our finance director here, and we're proud of the fact that the balance between what would be deemed to be an expert by education and expert by experience is kind of finely tuned within the teams that we've got at UCH. And all we can do is set example. We can't crack a whip. So I think that, yeah, we're happy with that. And but you're always going to get that. You see, there's lots of fear about involving people with a lived experience within the workforce, predominantly from the naive who believe, oh, I'm going to lose my job. I'm not going to be able to pay my mortgage or feed my children. And while that's going on, while they remain in that kind of mindset, that's where the problems lie. I think that I've always said it, and I've said it for a long time before I even got involved with Pathway, that involving people with lived experience within your workforce is not an instead of, it's an additional to. And you do it, you find additional funding to do it, and you support it as an additional and added service. It brings added value, so provide it as something that is added.
Oh, that's marvellous. Okay, we should be stopping, but ooh, if you can do 30 seconds each, and that's the last two questions.
I'll try to answer as quickly as I can. We struggle with the issue of end of life for 4 years. We have Peter Kennedy down, and it's been marvellous. And we piggybacked our homeless group with lots of experts by experience and hostel workers onto the local CCG strategy, so commissioners listen. And despite some good deaths, we've had the experience of where people have filled out our paperwork, as well as some very individual paperwork, badged by all the sort of voluntary sector, but don't feel able to do an advanced directive, which is their prerogative. And then when the ambulance gets there and the hospital staff say, this was a death we were aware of, you know, in a palliative phase, they're not believed by the ambulance service, who then jump all over the chest. And following that, put in a safeguarding because they felt that hospital staff hadn't sufficient. And of course, all that good work gets undone. I just wondered whether you had a comment on the difficulties envisaged in that.
Is the other question palliative care?
It's about involving social services.
Oh, okay. So if we do both.
I am Sonia Khoury from the Care Quality Commission. Thank you, Stan and Caroline, for everything. Just wanted to ask, you mentioned about the difficulties in involving social services. Have you involved them in the research, why they are difficult to be involved?
Social services, whole another subject.
No, thanks for both of those. Both really difficult questions. Thank you very much to end with. No, we haven't, but I think we will. And I think we have time within this study. And I think it's come up as being such a major problem that I think it is something we meat add-on, actually.
Substantial
so,
bit of it.
Yeah, and there's actually, there shouldn't be a problem with doing that. We can kind of get an extension from the ethics committee, but and we have time on our side. So I think we will plan to do that, actually.
Brilliant.
So, no, but thanks for raising that, because it is a really, really important point. And yes, I mean, I'm hoping that if we can get proper advance care plan, if, and there's so many ways this has to go, really. There's so many issues that need to be resolved. But one of them, if advanced care planning can be developed, then it may be that with the sort of CMC type model, that London Ambulance would be part of, if people are happy to have information shared, that London Ambulance would be part of sharing of that information, so that so that hospital staff, London Ambulance staff, and healthcare providers involved in somebody's care, they would all be sharing that, because that obviously is essential, really. And it's unfortunate that in Southampton that doesn't
seem
to happen.
When they're so young, and I say young, there's disbelief that there is no more that could be done with this individual,
yeah.
And yet it was very much the place they wanted to be cared for.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I'm so sorry, we better stop and have lunch, because we've also got to move on to the lunchtime discussions, the roundtable stuff coming up soon. And thank you to the speakers. We'll get a link up for the films. I'll get Mark Easton to put it up, you know, for everyone, so that you can all look at those when you get home. And thank you so much, you four, and at the back, and all these questions.
Sorry, can I just say, if anyone has any comments that they haven't had a chance or want to have some input, please email me. Yeah, I'd be delighted to hear from anybody.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yeah,
I
want to
say,
to
where
are
the commissioners involved for these hospitals? Because I commission services, I commission hospitals, and if my hospitals have any issues with getting social care access,